I will be talking about what for me underlies all this kind of work when it comes to doing circling and healing and relationship and conscious communication. I want to address what fundamentally seems to make all these kinds of relating practices possible. And for the sake of conciseness, I'll be leaving out a lot of details and things that I could talk about for a very long time. But my goal here is to just get my major points across for now. When I talk about things like this, people often respond to me with very valid concerns that I might not be speaking to directly, but understandably need to be clarified in order for you to get the full context of my point of view that I'm making my points in. And we can't quite engage in that back and forth the same way in a recording. So please keep that in mind if I miss something or don't exactly address something in this that's important to you. Everything I'm doing is a work in progress, and I'm hoping that if you are within range of where I'm coming from, you'll get something out of this. So, first I want to talk about how our sense of self and our experience of ourself is something that we could say comes out of, arises out of, relationship. We are all born dependent on our environment for survival. A baby can't take care of itself. It relies on its parents or caregivers or environment to survive and grow up, to be fed, held, to be kept warm, and so on. And it seems to me that somewhere in our culture or society, depends on the culture, of course, it seems often that there's this idea that at some point we grow up and outgrow our reliance on other people. We become seemingly self-sufficient and independent. We have our own job, our own material possessions, our own family and relationships and things like that, maybe. Or at an even more fundamental level, conceive of ourselves as a self that's fully individuated from others, a self separate from other selves. Sometimes being independent or self-sufficient in these kinds of ways seems to even be idealized in some cultures. And it's this idea of being separate, the idea that as an individual I can be separate from you and separate from the things around me, that I want to point out breaks down under examination. So, for example, I go around all day thinking in words to myself in English, and this is a massive portion of my day-to-day experience, but I didn't invent English. And I'm guessing that if we looked into it, we would find that languages are born out of entire cultural and historical contexts, out of whole ways of life and ways of thinking. So if I had learned a completely different primary language, not only would I think to myself in different words, but perhaps also have a point of view or way of thinking that came out of a different cultural context, and so I would think differently. You probably have some experience with this if you've studied another language or another culture than your primary culture. So it occurs more to me that the language in which I think and the way in which I think with the words of a language aren't really mine. There's something that I'm borrowing through a relationship with a culture, a relationship with other people. Similarly, the way that I learn how to think about myself, about who I am, is a process that comes out of relating with others. When I was in college, one of my professors and another teacher, local teacher I knew, took an interest in me and took the time to listen to some of the thoughts and ideas that I had about psychology. And I went to talk to them during their office hours and when they were available outside of classes. And through those interactions, I learned that my thoughts could be of interest or value to other people. And I didn't and couldn't have learned that about my ideas in a vacuum. It took a relationship, an exchange, for me to feel that what I had to say might be of use to someone. Similarly, I could have learned through interactions just as well that people don't value my thoughts if they didn't take the time to listen to me. My point here is that what I experience about myself comes through interaction, through relationship. I can't make a story about myself and who I am in a vacuum. My self is always defined in relation to other people, other selves. I therefore need others to decide who I am. To try to make this more concrete, here's an example that's a kind of generalization of something that I often see happens in the circling and other kinds of personal development workshops that I'm a part of. Sometimes we'll be in a workshop where there's a whole group of people, and one participant in the group will casually say something to the whole group, maybe share a bit about their experience. And then someone else, sometimes even the facilitator or teacher, will respond by pointing out how what the participant said was a brilliant thing. And hearing that, the participant perks up and is like, wow, until you pointed that out, I didn't realize that I had this capacity to say something brilliant. And to be clear, in these cases, I also find what the participant said to be valuable and brilliant. But from the view I am speaking to, it's not that what the participant said was inherently valuable in some objective way, and the response was just a recognition of that. It's that the response that the person or teacher gave to the participant changed the meaning of what the participant said. The meaning of what the participant said would have been completely different if no one responded or just brushed over it, or people just brushed over it. So there is no brilliance without someone else to respond to what one says with the evaluation that it is brilliant. Whether or not something is brilliant is a shared story, is an agreement, and yet this agreement has real tangible effects on our experience. The response the participant got changed how they felt about themselves and potentially their idea about what they're capable of. So again, it takes an exchange for me to tell a story about who I am in this way, and who you are, and who we are. When I say something, people's response to me gives meaning to what I say, and vice versa. This shared meaning, shared story, is an agreement, just like money is an agreement. A fiat currency, like the US dollar, has no gold backing it anymore. The paper or ink isn't really intrinsically valuable such that it gives money its dollar value. It's only because we share the story of money together that we believe in its value collectively, that the idea of its value becomes real to us and has a significant impact on our lives. In this sense, the thoughts that I think and the feelings and experiences that I have that I might think of in a conventional sense as belonging to me aren't only mine. They came out of the stories other people told with me about myself and them and about the world. And this process by which we tell stories together, make meaning together, isn't something that ends just because we reach a certain age when we become 18 or 21 and are called an adult and have done the things that any particular society deems as some version of individuation. Or even at a more fundamental level than that, at some point in our growing up, we begin to think of and experience ourselves as a whole and complete self, separate from other selves. This process of creating a story about who I am with others, who we are together, is something that I will be engaged with for my whole life. So my personal identity is potentially something that is constantly open to being changed through this process. Now, you and I might be in a kind of habit of thinking of our experience as something that is ours, that we have in private that we then choose to share publicly with others, be it close friends or posted on the internet. But insofar as I grew up in a culture, and that cultural relationship is the context and means through which I interpret and understand myself and my experiences through things like language, then my experiences are actually not private, but public relational experiences that I learn to have with others, which I then repeat by myself when others are not physically present with me. Just as I might have learned from my college professor that maybe what I have to say is interesting, and then think and feel that to myself, that maybe I'm interesting, when they're not around. You can think of it that my experience is not an independent thing, but a living process amidst a web of processes that are all in constant flux and in interaction with one another. If you're following what I'm saying, then I hope you understand that to say anything about any one person, an individual, like to say something about someone's brilliance or lack of brilliance, independent of the collective story-making process, doesn't really make sense because we are all participating in and together co-creating what we might think of conventionally as our individual experiences. I can't tell a story about someone else being brilliant or myself being brilliant in a vacuum without others. And again, just as in the examples I gave, this process has a real and tangible impact on what we feel and experience all the time. We organize our lives around these stories, just as we organize our lives around the story and belief in the value of money. Now, this view I'm speaking to matters to me because it opens us to tremendous possibility. It suggests that your experience and what you make of it is not fixed at all. Experiencing is a process that has a lot of flexibility and capacity for change as part of it. It's not set in stone and is forever open to reinterpretation and recreation. If something in experience appears to be set in stone, it may not be because it actually is set in stone, but because we story it, think and feel about it in such a way that makes it seem that way. So if we're willing to take the time to overcome our old habits of how we tell stories, we can create something entirely new, potentially completely different from what has come before. And we have an important role in the stories others tell about themselves and vice versa. And I want to suggest here that this is why circling and all these relational healing modalities, or whatever you want to call them, work, result in transformative experiences for people. Because to share one's experience, to speak it to others, even if it's just answering questions about what one's experience is to open my story of who I am, my personal self-identity, back up to reinterpretation, to new meanings that other people can give to it. And the interesting thing is that we do this with each other all the time, in a circle or out of a circle. And relational practice is a great modality, a tool to become conscious of how this process is always going on. This also means that viewing myself as an individual now, I have a lot of influence when it comes to co-creating experiences with other people, since we can see that I am an active participant in other people's experiences. Always. And at least for me, the awareness of this behooves me to seriously consider what exactly it is that I'm creating with others and why. To be conscious, aware of, awake to, and continuously develop and refine some discernment about what I'm doing, what I'm creating, because it has a real impact on others. So if my experience is not ultimately mine, and in the process of making meaning, of communicating together, we co-create our experiences together, then what's going on when we interact and be in connection? And what does it mean to be conscious and intentional when we are creating, with what we are creating in connection? So before I go into that, I need to clarify some things so that you hopefully don't misunderstand me. So I'm not saying that the idea of individuality doesn't exist or isn't important. I could talk about the value of the idea of individuality and its benefits. I'm trying to balance it out here a bit with its opposite, since I've met more people who have trouble conceiving of experience and their self as being relational than people who have trouble thinking of themselves as an individual separate self. So what I'm trying to do here is contextualize both the ideas of separateness and interconnectedness. Again, I'm speaking more to interconnectedness than individuality because I want to counteract what seems to be most people's way of thinking about themselves. But both individuality and connectedness are two ideas that rely on each other in order to exist. Individuality implies that there are separate things that can interact and be in relationship, just as relationship implies that there are separate entities relating. So separation and relationship are really one idea, two sides of the same coin. And I'm also not saying that nothing exists outside of culture. In integral theory terms, that would be a kind of lower left quadrant reductionism. Instead, I'm trying to point out what is going on in our experience and relationship when the primary means that we have to understand and interpret our experience is a cultural context, is relational. So, for example, like if one of our primary means of interpretation is a language that we borrow from our culture and carry around in our heads as ongoing dialogue. So, having said that, I'm going to switch over to a point of view that's about what we can do as individuals. And I'll go over the implications with what I've said so far for relationship and how we co-create our experiences together. Specifically, I'm going to be talking about what I think of as relational power. Power being the power to be conscious or intentional with what I'm doing, instead of out of habit, just doing whatever I've been doing until now and experiencing whatever I've been experiencing until now. The power to create an experience that's new or different, if it is particularly useful and empowering to a relationship to do so. Like, what is that? So, for example, if there's someone I don't get along with, rather than just have the same conflict with them over and over, or have the same experience with them that has me be unhappy with them, if I want to change how that goes, I will need to understand how to be skillful at weaving and co-creating a new experience, as I'm suggesting. Similarly, if there are certain circumstances or scenarios in my life where I keep having the same experience, but want to change what is possible for me in that area, I will hopefully have more options if I understand how to consciously co-create a new story, a new experience. So, for simplicity, I think there are three main components or principles that come out of the view that I'm suggesting here. I'll go over them one at a time. The first thing is that I need to be aware of much of what I've already been talking about, the process by which we co-create our experiences together. For example, when I sit across from someone in a circle or even just in a conversation and suggest to them, hey, you seem sad, and they agree, yes, I feel sad. What's going on here isn't just that we're trying to accurately understand someone's experience. We are together assigning an interpretation and thus meaning and significance to that person's experience. To jointly agree on interpreting someone's experience as sad will bring along with it whatever connotations and associations that are with it for them and for me. So, for example, common connotations that come along with sadness that I've heard in circles are things like sadness is a bad feeling that I shouldn't feel, or sadness shouldn't be shared with others because it will bring them down. These interpretations, connotations have, again, profound and real, tangible impacts on how we experience ourselves. If we together explicitly or implicitly agree that sadness is a feeling that someone shouldn't feel, then the person feeling sadness will likely not feel good when they feel sad if they take on that story as their experience. But what if instead of sadness, we decide on the interpretation together that what first appeared to be sadness was really a hurt part of that person that needs to be cared for? This opens a different set of possibilities and behaviors for that person. One such possibility might be that their hurt is worth sharing with others since it might get cared for by others. So if you have the chance to watch a conversation from this point of view, you can see this process, meaning-making, interpreting process happening often very quickly, and the way in which people in a conversation are co-creating, co-influencing, and having an experience in real time together, co-creating an experience in real time together as a result. I remember a circle in which a circlee was talking about their anxiety, clearly bothered by it, their unknown anxiety, and then someone else in the circle suggested that the person had social anxiety. And the circlee stopped being bothered by their unknown anxiety when they heard this and recognized, or rather from my view, reinterpreted their anxiety as social anxiety, likely because unexplained anxiety and social anxiety had different connotations for them. Right? So that changed their experience. And as useful and limited a tool words are to communicate our experience together to others, we are constantly engaged in this process with each other of co-creating experiences by explicitly and implicitly assigning meaning and interpretation to our experiences. And since those meanings and interpretations and associations are the main means of looking at and understanding our experience, especially in a cultural context, those interpretations become real to us. So we are tremendously powerful in that we have the capacity to change our interpretations and make new ones. Now, you've probably encountered situations in which it doesn't seem possible to come to some kind of agreement with other people about what interpretation to land on for something. So this brings me to my second point, which is that if we want to co-create new stories and experiences with other people, I need to be aware of the limitations people have in telling stories. We all have limitations on the kinds of stories we can tell. So I want to be capable of telling stories that reconcile my limitations and the limitations of others, that bridge our stories in spite of potential conflicts or chasms between them. So let me give you an example, concrete example, so that this makes sense. I often use this silly example of what it would be like if we sat down to circle someone or give someone a therapy session, and that person says that they don't think they're a valuable person. Wouldn't it be great if we could all just say to this person, "You're valuable," and they suddenly completely accept that they are valuable, and we can all be done and go home? So there might be exceptions, but it usually doesn't go that easily and doesn't work that way, because what the person is saying is not just that they don't have the idea that they're valuable, but they can't make meaning that way, and they can't construct the experience of what that is like to be valuable. And now, there are effective approaches in healing that do involve telling someone what their experience is and how the world works, but if we're circling, we're in the practice of welcoming someone where they're at, and we're hopefully not going to get into a position where we might argue with them about them being valuable, like, "You're valuable," "No, I'm not," "But you just don't see that you are." Instead, what often seems to paradoxically be more persuasive is to honor that person's limitations in what kind of stories they can tell, what kind of meaning and interpretation they can assign to their experience. So if instead I ask the person what the experience of not being valuable is like, they might give me examples of their experiences where people haven't treated them as valuable in the past and haven't responded to them in a way that would have this person know that they're a valuable person. To which then I might suggest to this person who doesn't feel valuable that maybe it's not that they're not valuable as some absolute truth about them or part of their identity, but rather that they just haven't yet had the experience of other people treating them as though they are valuable. Hopefully to which the person opens to the possibility of changing their story about themselves as not being valuable in some absolute sense. So I've had many moments like these in circles where maybe someone who we have our attention on feels anxiety about doing circling well or being interesting or entertaining for others. And when I slow down and actually look at what the anxiety is with them, I often find people have specific memories in which they learn to anticipate being judged by others. And so it makes sense that they feel anxious in the moment. When we actually be with these memories and experiences, they unfold and change, and the anxiety usually goes away. And in terms of helping someone heal or transition their story, this seems to work better than treating the person as though they are just an anxious person in some absolute sense. So this process of conversing like this is one way of bridging stories while acknowledging someone's limitations in the kind of story they can tell. I can potentially bridge the story of not being valuable with being valuable. And this way we can hopefully cooperate in the process of co-creating a new experience together rather than get into the "you're valuable, no I'm not" kind of argument. And I won't go into detail here, but you can imagine how the capacity to reconcile stories like this is incredibly useful in shifting all kinds of conflicts, both between people, groups, and conflicting parts of our own internal experience. I think of it as being an essential part of any transformative process. In order to transition the old story, old experience, into something new, I need to be able to tell this kind of transitory story. Now, again, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but I do want to say that conflict isn't necessarily a bad thing. But I personally typically find that when I tell stories in a way that resists or pushes against people's limitations without honoring them and creates conflict or argument in doing so, people tend to feel things like shame in the face of not feeling accepted and will start being defensive. And that can add obstacles to what I'm doing in that I often need to work through that defensiveness first until we can cooperate again in co-creating a new story for whatever we were originally talking about. So in this way, we are, through interaction, co-creating an experience by together deciding on interpretations. And we are all limited in the kinds of interpretations we can make. So if we can honor that and find a new way to bridge, the new story with the old, rather than just reject the old, reject how things are, hopefully we are more successful and won't just end up in a conflict that reinforces our stories about shame, non-acceptance, and needing to be defensive. And in spite of best intentions, sometimes we are so limited such that conflict is the only option that we can co-create with others. So, let me come to my third and final point, the third part of the capacity to co-create new experiences with others. If I want to be intentional about how I am co-creating experiences with other people, then it's probably better for me to be conscious and aware of what exactly it is that I'm creating and why. If I'm not aware of this, then that's how my old habits have me, rather than me having and wielding this relational process of co-creating in a intentional way. So in discussing this, I want to point out first that when it comes to my personal self, there is no such thing as absolute neutral, especially when it comes to communication. If you took a big enough sample of things that I say or do, let's just say a sample of my communications, you would be able to analyze it and begin to see the things that are important to me and the things that aren't important to me. Right? When I communicate, I have to make choices and prioritize saying or doing one thing over other things. I choose certain words over other words, like the word sadness instead of grief. Or at an even bigger level, everything that I say and do takes the place of an infinite number of things that I could have said or done. So even to not say anything isn't neutral, because it is to choose silence, to elevate silence as a priority over other options. I mean, also, language is not neutral, right? In order for my words to make sense, I need to place them in a specific order. I need to follow a certain kind of logic. Otherwise, what I'm saying won't be comprehensible. So to speak in words is to call upon that kind of logic of language and to prioritize how we experience and perceive things through the interpretive lens of that logic over other potential modes of experiencing. Anyway, so my communication can't ever be neutral because in all kinds of ways, but because I'm always prioritizing something over something else. My communication is a reflection of my hierarchy of values, of my point of view, my priorities, whether I'm consciously aware of them or not. So given this, when I communicate, I'm always persuading other people around me into my point of view. Not because I'm trying to manipulate or control people, right? People do that, but that's not what I'm talking about right now. I'm talking about influence and persuasion that happens because of the very way in which communication functions. Communication is a move in the dance of co-creation. It is influence. So I'm constantly trying to persuade people through my communication to engage with my values, my priorities, which may not necessarily be theirs. So if I want to wield this co-creative process consciously, I need to have some self-awareness of what my values are, what my point of view is. Now, I'm not saying that you should somehow have this all magically and completely figured out before you say anything, or stop being spontaneous, or only have interactions within the territory that you completely and absolutely understand. What I'm saying is that relational practice is a container in which you can take the time to slow down enough to be self-aware and reflect on what your values are, what you want to co-create with others, and see whether or not the way you do things actually does create the thing that you want, so you can then bring your communication and how you're being with others into congruence with your values. And that will give you more capacity to co-create experience with others, hopefully through your whole life. And when I train new people to circle, I often see them speaking and communicating in ways that are kind of directionally disjointed, like they haven't quite figured out what they want to create, what they're valuing, and they also haven't tied everything that they do and everything that they say and how they're being to that bigger picture. So they will slightly go in one direction, and then another direction, and then a third direction. And there's nothing wrong about this. To be in this kind of exploration is a valuable and necessary learning process. But in terms of co-creating something with another person, they usually end up going in a lot of directions, but not going in any one direction enough to create any one thing in particular. And the potency of what they can co-create with others gets kind of dispersed and watered down as a result. So the more I'm conscious about my values, what I want to create, the more I can bring all of myself into congruence with my values and be intentional rather than have my old habits co-create whatever they usually do. And again, it's not that someone needs to have their values all figured out right away, but hopefully I am in a continual process of forever considering and refining what I stand for when it comes to our collectively co-created human experience. I'm continually making conscious what I'm already doing and thinking about whether or not that is actually what I want to do, to be exposing myself to other values and trying them on so that I can see the limitations and blind spots of my own point of view and expand my point of view to cover for previous limitations and also understand the limitations of other points of view. To be continually growing in my complexity and understanding, but also be as comfortable as I can wherever I am at. So, I could go into a lot more, but I'll save that for another video in terms of understanding values and how those are enacted and come into some degree of realization through co-creation, although I've kind of alluded to it already. But to summarize everything I've covered, my experience is not only my experience. It is something that is a co-creation through our collective meaning-making process. My experience is also our experience, our story, feelings, and thoughts about who I am and who you are. And we are in a continual process of deciding who we are through our relations with others. Since culture is my environment, and I grow up in a culture, I can't decide who I am without you. And for me to engage with you is also to potentially open the story of who I am up to new meanings and interpretations. As long as we are willing and have the resources to work through our old habits of how we tell stories, we can create new ones for and with each other. In terms of me learning how to skillfully utilize this process so that I can co-create new things, new stories, and experiences with others, that means that I, one, need to be aware that we are constantly co-creating experiences together in our interactions, that I persuade people in engaging with my values in every interaction, even when I'm not blatantly trying to convince someone of something. And my values guide my interactions, whether I am explicitly aware of those values or not. Two, I need to be able to see that people have limitations in the kinds of stories they can participate in, and be telling stories that create bridges to new possibilities, new stories. And three, I need to be conscious of what I want to create so that I can bring myself into congruence with my values and be effective at creating what I want to create, and continually be updating and upgrading what my values are. And I care about circling and teach circling in relational practice because it is such a powerful, I think it's such a powerful environment in which we can learn how to do these things and open ourselves to co-create new and beautiful experiences together. I want to end this recording by leaving you with the vast amount of possibility that this view opens us to. Again, I think there are things that exist outside of the framework of culture, but it's hard for me to think about anything that I get up in the morning to do with my life that hasn't been in some way touched by this shared cultural meaning-making process. And all that meaning is continually open to change, open to reinterpretation and new meanings, to new possibilities that maybe I can't even imagine. And I think we have an integral role to play together in consciously tending to the co-creation of this culture and experience that we find ourselves interconnected in. So thanks for listening. I hope you got something out of that. You can find more information about me and content like this on my website at www.whatiscircling.com. Thanks.